Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Welcome to Our House, the only complete on-air resource for your home ownership needs. Now, here's the host of Our House, Peter Hunt.
Good morning and welcome to Our House. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the continuously improving HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and home ownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA here in Buffalo Niagara and all across upstate New York, and also through our links to Boston, Massachusetts, and Phoenix, Arizona. This show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, NMLS number 37405. Hunt Mortgage is proudly an equal opportunity lender. Call them today, 633-3700, and ask one of our very skilled mortgage consultants to work with you to find the lowest rate and closing cost for your particular home financing needs and wants, and that's always our guarantee. And then today's very competitive market, you want to make sure that you understand really what's going on. And it's only through working with a mortgage consultant that you can do that. Also ask about our many exclusive programs, including our unique pre-purchase commitment that allows you at no cost or risk to effectively enter the market to find your next home with cash in today's very competitive residential real estate market, where there is still a shortage of listings, believe it or not. When you find the house you want, you'll want to make sure that your offer is as strong as possible when there's still often more than one offer. And we just checked on that this week around the company, and we're still seeing multiple offers all across the six regions that we work in. And some from a seller's perspective, cash is very persuasive. But if you're working with a skilled Hunt sales professional armed with a pre-purchase commitment, your offer is the equivalent of cash, and don't let anyone tell you otherwise. And you may find yourself now in a house that was right for you when you bought it years ago, but you've outgrown it, or maybe it's even outgrown you. In any case, it no longer meets your lifestyle, but where are you going to go, even if you were to sell for a great price? Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate have combined to solve that problem through the Golden Gate, the bridge to your next home. We've combined a bridge loan and a guaranteed sale on your present home to get you out looking for that right house for you and your family right now. To learn more about any of our unique programs, call Hunt Mortgage today, 716-633-3700 for personalized, customized service that will knock your socks off. Hunt is the official real estate and relocation provider of our hometown professional teams, the Buffalo Bills and the Buffalo Sabres, and we're also proud supporters of our Buffalo Bisons, and we're going to the game today, and we're glad to see them here still. I think this may be one of their last games, but anyway, we're going to be there cheering them on. We are broadcast live on WBEN 930 AM and 98.5 FM HD3, and you can listen live anywhere in the world through the Odyssey app or at WBEN.com. And for those of you who'd like to participate in today's show, if you have any questions or comments about anything my guests may address or any aspect of real estate for that matter, call or text us in the studio. It's the same number, 716-803-0930. And if you're long distance, you can reach us by phone at 1-800-616-9236. And if you're mobile, it's *930. Those are all free calls, so join us on the air at Our House. We have a very special show for you today. After some 3 years, pre-pandemic, I'm glad to welcome back to the studio a good friend of our community, Nick Sinatra, president and of Sinatra & Company Real Estate, which is a privately held real estate firm. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Peter. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back. Nick, it's been a few years, and I think many of our listeners have heard about you or read about you, but take us back in history a little bit of Nick Sinatra and bring us kind of up to date on your journey so far.
Well, certainly it's been an interesting journey, especially the last 3 years since the last time I was on the show. But I guess to give your listeners a little bit of a flavor, born and raised here in Buffalo, lived in the city of Buffalo and then moved to Kenmore My family is Sinatra's restaurant. My brother owns a restaurant now. My father started it 41 years ago, so we grew up in the restaurant business, and I'm a proud St. Joe's alum. I actually go into the St. Joe's Canisius game here this afternoon, pretty excited about it. And then I went off to Yale. I played football there, and we actually won an Ivy League championship there when I was playing football with them, which was
really?
A lot of fun. Yeah.
That's great.
And then I worked in politics for a stint, 5 years. I worked for Governor Pataki and then President Bush down in Washington during his second term, and that was really exciting. But I realized I didn't want to do that for a career. Once you get down there to Washington, it's that old saying, once you see how the sausage is made, you don't really want to eat sausage anymore. So once I got down there, that was 20 years ago. So you can imagine how much worse politics have gotten over the last 20 years. They haven't gotten better, I can promise you that. So I was a little turned off by the process, and I said, you know what, this is not going to be my career path. So I went back to business school. Turned out to be interesting timing because that was during the Great Recession that I was in business school, which was probably the best place to be because that was such a catastrophic time in our economy. But it was interesting to be in an academic setting during those years. And it allowed us to really study the recession and the collapse of the real estate market, you know, from a different perch. And I decided I was going to start a real estate company, partially out of necessity because I wouldn't have been able to get a job coming out of business school in that time frame, especially being a political hack and not having any real, you know, real estate experience. So I started making some phone calls, raised some money, after about 50 no's, I finally got a yes, and we raised some cash and bought a 6-unit apartment building in Amherst. It's actually the property right next to the Bocce Pizza on Bailey.
Really?
6 units, 6 small apartments in the first floor. There were 3 little retail spaces that were unrented, and we purchased it for $205,000, $60,000 in cash, and the rest was a mortgage. And kind of just grew it from there. And now we have over 4,500 apartments in 5 states, and we have a very robust development pipeline here in Western New York. And we've actually finished over $100 million in development over my 13 years in business. But we actually have equal size pipeline, if not bigger. And we can talk about that. But there's a lot that we're working on here locally in Western New York. And it's despite the turmoil in the markets and expected to be turmoil in the economy, I still think there's a lot of opportunity here in Western New York.
No question about it. You were on just prior to the pandemic, and neither of us had any idea what was going to happen. Nobody did. And then as the year went on, we got towards the end of the year, this news of this strange virus was circulating around the world, and all of a sudden it showed up on our shores and the whole world changed. I know that's been particularly difficult for people like you that own a lot of apartments, particularly those apartments that happen to be in states that have been, let's say, more militant about the shutdown than other states. What exactly, what was your experience through that process, and how did it affect you and your business?
Yeah, it was an interesting arc when you think about that spring season there, March, April, May of 2020, when nobody really knew what was happening. It was very scary, and most people were shut down working from home. You know, being in the real estate business, being in the apartment business, we have to service people in their homes. So my team couldn't be working from home. They actually had to be going into people's homes. So that was pretty interesting, and that was a sort of one phase, right, where we were making sure that we were protecting our staff to go in there and service people as they were our tenants and customers, and also doing so in a way where we didn't really know how to treat the virus, how to control it, how deadly it was, et cetera, et cetera. And then things changed, and we started to understand it better, and then the vaccines came, and so I would say at that point in time, things were pretty much similar in every state. You know, we have properties in Illinois, Indiana, Florida, Pennsylvania, and upstate New York here, Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse. So I would say for the first 18 months, things were relatively the same because in terms of the reaction and response. But then things started to splinter, and you know, states like New York started to treat landlords differently than tenants and other states, Florida, Indiana in particular, it started to be a little bit more business friendly in terms of the response when things started to settle down. And, you know, the eviction moratorium was something that out of the gates became, I can understand why government officials thought that that was a good idea, but it dragged on much too long and started to create some very negative incentives for tenants, really fractured the tenant-landlord relationship, which is still a big problem to this day. I think there's a lot of strain between tenant and landlord that's going to take a long time to heal. My staff has a hard time viewing tenants that have treated us as landlords so poorly over the last 2 years as customers. And we have to get back into the customer service business. We're really trying to push that on my staff. But those that are still here, because I've gone through dozens of property managers over the pandemic because they have just been stressed out by basically being debt collectors, especially in New York State. And they've many of them have left and just taken different career paths because they said, you know what, this isn't what I signed up for. So that it's been an interesting 2.5 years. And you know, most of the properties I have outside of New York State are business back. But, you know, it's business as usual, back to normal. In New York State, my collections, Peter, are the same as they were in the early parts of the pandemic, meaning I still have a number of people not paying me rent. And so it's very frustrating.
I can only imagine. One of the things that you failed to mention in terms of your background is your family during that pandemic period. You had a child, which is great. And so how old is Henry now?
So Henry was born in January of 2020. So he's almost three now. And you know, that was an interesting time because he was born and then we rolled right into the pandemic. So That's really exciting. We love him. He's a great boy. And you know, that was, if there was a silver lining in the pandemic, it was the fact that I was able to spend so much time with him in his early months that I probably wouldn't have. And it reset some level of work-life balance. You know, that was, I think, for me personally, one of the areas that I feel like reset in a positive way in the pandemic is I get up now in the morning and I spend time with Henry, I get him up, and I feed him breakfast and get him ready for the day. And that never would happen if there weren't the pandemic, because I would be out the door really probably before he even gets up most days, you know. But now, and I'm able to work at home while I'm getting him ready for the first couple hours in the morning. So that's been really nice.
I want to come back to that because this has a huge effect on real estate, of course, that work-life balance thing and where people work. A study just came out this week that said that 47.5% of all employees that used to go to the office are back at the office. That still leaves 52.5% that aren't, which puts a lot of stress on landlords that may own office space like we do. We're not at all really in the residential business like you are. But let's go back to this issue of exactly how deals are put together in your world such that you can deliver an affordable unit, which really is a great challenge in Buffalo as it is in many cities. But in Buffalo, it may be particularly acute because of the fact that we have, you know, relatively poor population compared to other cities around the country. The other cities that you're involved with, Florida, for example, I'm sure every city you're involved with down there is a wealthier city per capita than we are here. Chicago probably is a wealthier city than we are here. In Indiana, I know which cities you're in Indiana, but I do know there are several cities that are quite wealthy in Indiana. So we have that problem, and you quite articulately went through how you can deliver through tax incentives and tax credits, et cetera, how you can deliver an affordable unit. Last night I had a conversation with one of the directors of our company about affordable housing and how difficult it is to even conceive of affordable housing in this country or anywhere in the world today. And the fact that we had this run-up in real estate values over the last couple of years, for all the kinds of reasons I'm sure you're well-versed on, it's made it even worse. So how do you see that evolving? You've got the built-in problem that you described, that where there's government has come in on one side of the equation and said you're not going to get paid. And then on the other side of the equation, to help incent you to do more development and construction, they create tax advantages, et cetera, to go ahead and do that. But But how do you see the whole issue of affordable housing evolving here in Western New York or anywhere?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. So let's start with some basic supply and demand metrics. So it's widely believed by national real estate economists that we're about anywhere between four or five million units underhoused, meaning between single family homes and apartment units, so that there is a bigger demand than supply out there throughout the country. In certain regions, that's, you know, it's going to be that imbalance is higher than others. But I could tell you there is an imbalance here in Western New York, and I'm sure you see it on the residential side. But on the apartment side, there still is a need for apartments, and specifically amongst affordable, right? So let's talk about then what it takes to build a market rate versus an affordable complex. So market rate apartment complex, if you build it, it's pretty traditional. You've got a debt from a lender anywhere between 70 to 75% of the cost, and then you have developer equity that's in the form of cash or contributing land, combination typically of both. And then in some cases you've got historic tax credits if it's a rehab, or maybe there's some other type of incentive to make the numbers work. So that's pretty straightforward. The affordable housing is much more complicated, and over the arc of the last 50 years, it's taken different forms of how government has tried to incentivize affordable housing. You know, it went from full government ownership, right, in the form of housing authorities, where the government was, the city governments and state governments were actually building these units and running themselves, into trying to incentivize private development and ownership of these units through tax credits, right? So there's this low-income tax credit program, which is a federal program through HUD, Housing and Urban Development, through the U.S. Department of HUD. But then it's administered by the states and the localities. And as you can imagine, in each state it's different. And in New York State, it's very difficult and very difficult to administer and to work through. So it's very cumbersome, and it's a process that over the course of maybe 2 years, you finally get the tax credits with the banks and necessary nonprofit groups typically to help administer the credits and work through it. So it's a complicated process that I won't get into with your listeners, other than the fact to say that it's too laborious, and as a result, we have fewer affordable units than we should. And I think we have to, as a community, figure out a way to provide a different financing package to incentivize affordable housing. And I have some thoughts on it, and we can talk about it if you'd like. But we did a affordable housing project on Jefferson Avenue with People Inc. Really, really great project. 89 apartment units that were all affordable. Actually, 16 of them were for disabled folks. It was sold out before you can before we even opened, and there's a 300 person wait list right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how would, just to jump on that, that would say, well, let's build 300 more.
Exactly. But just to give you a little snippet of how the program just doesn't make much sense, the way that New York State handles this program. We built on two parcels on Jefferson Avenue, and I owned a third one next to it. And given the success of the first two, you figure, well, let's just build another carbon copy structure right next to it. That's what a private developer would do. But that's not how New York State Department of Housing and Community Renewal thinks about it. They actually think about it the opposite and say, well, you're too close to the existing project, and you're going to cannibalize the existing project. So you have to wait 12 months from the day of full stabilization to actually even apply for the program, right? So that's just a little snippet of how the program is not business friendly and is not producing affordable units. So I think there is probably anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 affordable units needed, and just in the city of Buffalo alone.
Say that number again.
Between 5,000 and 10,000.
I agree.
And given the pace of, just look at the last 10 years of how many units have been built out. You know, it's kind of a maybe 100 or 200 at max have been put online every single year. So maybe over the arc of the last 10 years, we've had 1,000, 1,500 units, and that might even be high. So the problem is not going to be solved given the current finance options that we have right now. I think we really, as a group and as stakeholders, need to get in a room and figure out a way to rethink how affordable housing is delivered in New York State.
I want to come back to that, but you have a fan out here that has texted us. Tim from Kenmore says, "Hello, Nick. I don't know, 10 years ago, Nick employed a bunch of Kenmore guys on the Mike's sub block. He gave me an opportunity to still today see my work still looking good. Besides the job, I always appreciated that. Thanks, Nick." So there you got a fan.
Thanks, Tim.
We have a caller online. We'll take in a second here, too. But what you said about two things, 4 to 5 million units underhoused in this country. A lot of that is new housing, single-family housing. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to what you were saying about your experience during the recession being in school. We went from about almost 2 million units a year being built, new housing units in this country, to 400,000. And that has still never come back. So each year that there's the gap between what the demand was, which was clearly around 2 million units, and what there's actually building, accumulates that 4 to 5 million number right. that you're talking about. So it's not magic. It's not a number you made up. It's clear based on history. And in the meantime, people need to live someplace. And so unfortunately, they go into substandard housing or they live together in multi-generational housing, which is also something I'd love to hear your thoughts on as we go forward here. But let's take one caller here before
Great.
We go to a break, because I want to come back to the topic that we were just on. Gary from Boston, how can we help you?
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, my wife and I own income property, and both tenants stopped paying. And luckily, my wife's a realtor, and she sort of knows the ins and outs. So we applied for reimbursement from the state, and it took forever and tons of phone calls and returns. You didn't fill this out properly or that properly, but we finally did get about $6,000 to help the loss. Now, I'm curious, Nick, in your experience in the same issue, how have you fared? Have you been reimbursed for loss?
So, sorry that you had to go through it. The part of the issue here is the governments and some of these more heavy-handed states have created this narrative that the landlord is like the monopoly man with the hat on and, drives his expensive car down the street. But the reality of it is that most landlords in America
are just like Gary.
Absolutely. People that are entrepreneurial and are looking for some income to supplement their 9-to-5 income, right? And it's a huge risk for them, and it's a huge effort. And if the tenants stop paying, it could end up ruining them financially, right? And I've heard that story time and time again. So, what's different is our company, we have the resources to have staff every single day track all that down, right? And go for the reimbursement. So it's a different and we know the laws and we're able to put together systems internally to try to get the reimbursements a little bit more expeditiously than some of these landlords that may not understand the process. But that all being said, the money has run out, right? I mean, the system wasn't set up to reimburse for 12, 14, 16 months. And that's the problem. So the long answer is no, we're not getting reimbursed anymore, and people are not paying, and there's no more money to reimburse anymore. So it's a real challenge out there.
I don't want to end on a negative note, but we do have to go to a break. We'll be right back with more from our house tiers after these very important messages.
Buying a home can be challenging, especially if you need to sell your current house first. Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate are here to help with the Golden Gate, the bridge to your next home. This innovative program features a bridge loan from Hunt Mortgage along with a guaranteed sale of your current home when you partner with a Hunt Real Estate sales professional. Visit huntmortgage.com/Golden Gate for more details. The Golden Gate from Hunt Mortgage and Hunt Real Estate. Your equity when you want it, your home sold guaranteed. Terms and conditions apply. Hunt Mortgage is a licensed mortgage banker, NMLS 37405, New York Department of Financial Services, and an equal opportunity lender.
Welcome back to our house. This is Peter Hunt, and the show is brought to you by the continuously improving HuntRealEstate.com, where everything is truly easier for your real estate and homeownership experience. HuntRealEstate.com is the only place on the web where you can find not only a complete inventory of homes available in any of the markets we serve, but you're also going to find access to a complete set of homeownership services at huntrealestate.com, which is powered by Hunt Real Estate ERA. The show is also brought to you by Hunt Mortgage, and for more information about our exclusive program, that is your assurance of the lowest rate and closing costs, the Second Look program, call 633-3700 and ask for details. If you watch television at all or turn your computer on or your phone, you're inundated with mortgage offerings, particularly to refinance your current home or whatever program you have. How will you know that you're getting the very best deal? Well, let us take a second look. Through Hunt Mortgage's Second Look program, there's no cost or risk, and we're so convinced that this will help you, you're going to receive a gift certificate just for allowing us to take that second look at whatever you received from any other lender. Also ask about our pre-purchase commitment and our Golden Gate, the bridge to your next home, only at Hunt Mortgage, 716-633-3700. My guest in the studio today, it's a very special show, is Nick Sinatra, the president of Sinatra & Company. We've been talking about kind of a wide range of topics, as you know, Nick, about relative to housing, and which is really, from a rental perspective anyway, your specialty. But it's only one of your specialties. You're also involved in other types of real estate as well, and we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go through the show here. But prior to the break, you were we were all kind of lamenting about the restrictions that were imposed during the pandemic that have really caused hardships for landlords. And one thing you mentioned, I think, is particularly a salient point, and that is that most investors are not like Nick Sinatra. Most owners of real estate, income-producing real estate, don't look like you. They're like Gary, who called in, that they own one or two units, that they might buy a double as their first house, and they have a second unit to offset their costs. And that's their way of building some equity and and also getting a little piece of a future, something they can pass on to their children. It's something that obviously we promote wholeheartedly, and it's a wonderful way to get a start and to really build some wealth. But those people can't sift through the system. And as you described, you have the staff and the expertise to work your way through it, such as it is. But you also said they're out of money. So it kind of puts you behind the eight ball here in New York State. And yet you've got a bunch of other projects underway right now. People could drive by them. For example, Bryant and Elmwood. There's a bunch of stuff, that whole former house hospital complex. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so we, pre-pandemic, we won the RFP to redevelop the former Women's and Children's Hospital of Buffalo, which is a beautiful structure right in the heart of the Elmwood Village. And we branded Elmwood Crossing with Ellicott Development as our development partner. And the concept really is this live, work, play environment where there's going to be apartments for rent, condos for sale. There's going to be office space available and retail and restaurants. So we're in what I'll call the second phase now. We were able to get one structure up pre-pandemic and work on another old hospital, which is a historic tax credit, adaptive reuse of the old complex into apartments. And People Inc. is actually working on 44 affordable units in that structure as well, which is really great. And we were able to build a daycare center. So we were able to make some progress, but unfortunately, the delays and work stoppages during pandemic slowed us down. And then now here we are afterwards, and construction costs are up 25%. And so that has also created a different set of challenges. But we're excited about the project. And there's, I would say, about three more years of development there to really finish it out.
You touch on something very important, and that is the cost of building today. And one of our listeners has texted us and said, what is classified as affordable housing cost-wise? So people can only afford so much, and there must be some kind of average that the government works on to define affordable housing. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because we talk about affordable housing, but it's actually a very complicated topic, because there's different definitions of it, and there's different ways that the government defines it, and there's different ways that the industry defines it. But essentially, it's all based on the zip codes, the median income, and it's set by the U.S. HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and there's different median income thresholds. It starts at 40%, 60%, 80%, 100, and 120, and there's a band there, and the tax credits define sort of how many units need to fit in each band. And so that's essentially how it works. But there's also what I'll call workforce housing, right? So there's that, there's the one piece that is somewhat financed by government or government tax incentives. And then there's this concept of workforce housing, which would be affordable, affordable with lowercase a, meaning it's an approachable price point, but it's not subsidized in any way by the government, right? And that is a humongous band of demand in America. Right?
I mentioned that's the service workers.
Absolutely, it's the folks that are fully employed and that are making a decent wage, but they're not, you know, they don't have the means at this point to buy a home, right? So it's a wide band of people in America, and that is getting squeezed now because we can't build enough affordable units, you know, through government financing, which I mentioned, because the programs are pretty bureaucratic, and then the new construction that is happening is all market rate and very expensive, right? So in order to justify building a new market rate structure, you have to have the rents on the back end that are going to be much higher than this workforce housing group can afford, right? So for example, if you're building a brand new, let's just use, you know, even numbers to illustrate the point for your listeners, but if you're building a new structure, you may have to charge $2,500 or $3,000 a month to make it work for that unit. Well, that's a lot of money for folks in terms of the percentage of their take-home pay every month. So, you know, what about the folks in between? What about the people that need that can only afford, you know, $600-$700 a month, or up and through, you know, $1,500 to $1,800 a month? I mean, that's really the majority of the renter out there, right? And so that product is really getting squeezed because it's impossible to build. Literally, it's impossible to rebuild that product around the country because the economics just don't support it. And that is the greatest need.
You know, it's interesting. There's a core group of developers around the country that are building housing specifically targeting 55 plus without services. And it's a very interesting product, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. You may be even building some of these homes. But the beauty of that product is that, generally speaking, those people are coming from a home that they own. And that's one of the great things that we love to see, because then that frees up the house, and these people have cash, equity. Maybe even they've worked a reverse mortgage, which we've talked about in this show. It's a whole another topic. But the bottom line is that there's a way to kind of segment that market that you're in, such that we increase the supply of existing housing for the families that want to obviously own a home. And there's many more than there is availability right now. Still, even with interest rates rising, et cetera. At the same time, you've got that core group that you're talking about that just need a place to live. They've got a decent job, and they want to improve their family and their life. We've been working with this group obviously a lot, and that's a whole second show, which we can't do right now. But this is in my mind the critical element. We've had Bob Shibley on the show here. We've had other experts on affordable housing, had politicians on the show, and you've provided the clearest definition that anyone has so far. But we have a bunch of callers. Let's take a call. This is Gustav from Williamsville. Gustav, how can we help you?
Hi, good morning. People speak universally about price per unit, but it seems to blend a lot of very disparate types of rental properties, one bedroom, two bedrooms, how many baths and so forth. And wouldn't it be clearer to talk about price per square foot, either rental or value-wise, as people do in more regularly in commercial real estate?
And also in terms of what's included in that $600 or $800. So how would you respond to that?
Yeah, so there, it's a good point. I mean, there definitely is a price per square foot as we look at it from a construction cost, and there's also a rent per square foot. It's odd though that we quote price per square foot in the rental business for apartments on a monthly basis. So I'll say, oh, it's $1.50 a square foot, versus a commercial lease would quote it as an annualized cost. So it's just kind of one of those weird nuances in the industry where, you know, people talk about price per unit versus price per square foot, and then even in the price per square foot, it's kind of quoted differently amongst property types. So it's I can't explain why, but it's just the industry norm.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. One of the things that concerns me as we look at various sections of our city, and really every city in the redevelopment, and you've been deeply involved in, I read a bunch of stuff this morning early about some of the projects that you've done that really taken properties that were built for some other reason, like a convent, for example, and you've converted that into apartments. And that's exciting stuff because it repurposes a building that otherwise is obsolete. It's just not going to go on the way it is. But the fact of the matter is, and you mentioned another thing about live, work, play, which I think is a critical element. In order for our central business district to really, really come back the way it should, what do you think we need right downtown in terms of housing units? I've asked the mayor this question too.
You illustrate a great point. As we think about what the world looks like coming out of the pandemic and providing more housing, whether it's for sale or for rent product, a lot of it's going to have to be repurposing, because if you think about, you either have raw land or you've got a building or a set of buildings to repurpose. And so the raw land typically is more rural or suburban, and most people now find affinity towards living in a more urban setting. And I think that it still hasn't changed. It's changed a little bit during the pandemic, but I think it's going to normalize, and people want to be near each other and want to be near services and entertainment to a lesser extent, their work. But, you know, I think especially the younger group really wants to be closer to entertainment and socialization versus work, which is an interesting topic that we can talk about in a different show. But, you know, downtown, my office is downtown, and during the day, post-pandemic, there's nobody there. I mean, most workers are not back to work yet downtown, and there just is not enough critical mass from a residential standpoint to supplement that, right? So in order to have a fully functional 24-hour city in the downtown core, you need to have, I would think, 2,000-4,000 more units down there. Right now, I'm just throwing a number, I'm just guessing, there's probably only a couple thousand units down there. And I would say in order to have a really vibrant downtown community, you need 5,000 minimal. At least given the size of our central business district. And that would really help create a sense of place and create demand for restaurants and other retail services, salons, et cetera, that would really thrive, that have been struggling the last few years.
No question about it. You know, if you look at cities like Toronto or New York, the major really high-quality cities in this country, if you look at that relationship between people working in any geographic segment that you may, X number of blocks, it's almost, in the healthiest cities, it's almost one for one. In other words, there's one person living there for every job that exists there. Well, as you point out, that's blown apart through the pandemic. People aren't going back to the office yet. The number I quoted earlier, 47.5%, is probably accurate here, and something like that here in town too. I know the banks, everybody's struggling to get people back in the office. What do you say to them without alienating them, and what kind of demands can you put on them? Goldman Sachs can say, you got to come back to work. Well, they've got real economic financial power to exert on these people, but they come back grumbling. They don't come back willingly. But so if you look at that kind of ratio, if you say there's normally 55,000 people working in the Central Business District, somewhere in that number, Mike Chavon was on to discuss this a few weeks ago. That would mean that we need, say, if there's two people or 2.5 people per housing unit, that means we need 20,000 units down there. And we don't have anywhere near that, as you point out. There might be a couple thousand right now. And until that balance gets closer, businesses will struggle. A restaurant will struggle. Certainly an office building will struggle. And it's very, very interesting what's happening. Another caller on the line, Nick. This is John from Rochester. John, how can I help you? John, are you there? Did you drop something?
Hey, Nick. No, my weight. I'm working out here. No. But listen.
Don't want to disturb you there, John.
That's right. That's right. Nick, you know, I have to laugh sometimes. I think to myself, I've seen some affordable housing projects that cost as much as $300,000 to $400,000 a unit. And I think affordable, that doesn't sound affordable to me. What guidelines can you give us on what the per unit costs are for affordable housing, from a minimum to a maximum?
You know, that's a great comment. They just announced here in Buffalo, a developer was selected to do the old Perry Complex downtown here, which is an old Housing Authority era development that houses a number of folks that are in the affordable space, and they're going to redo that whole complex and build some new units and rehab existing units. And the overall price per unit, if you look at the price that was announced in the paper versus how many units they're going to put on, it's somewhere between $300,000 and $400,000 per unit. And you quoted almost the exact number. And you scratch your head and you just say, boy, that's really expensive, because I could build a lot cheaper on a sure. for a market rate, right? But that's part of that is being subsidized by the government, right? And so the economics there are a little bit different, because the government then sets the standards for what they're looking for in terms of number of bedrooms and design standards, and because they're essentially setting the rent where it is and keeping the rent low, and then they pay out a developer fee versus the developer making money from the cash flow and the appreciation. You really make your money on those projects from a fee paid out by the government, which inflates the cost as well up front.
Will the government manage that project afterwards then, or will private developers
Private developers do, but typically there's nonprofits or developers that specialize in low-income housing management, because it's completely different than market rate, because there's a lot of compliance involved with it. And the tenants have to be screened, et cetera, things of that nature. But, you know, it's a good question. And costs have gone up, though. I will say that. I mean, costs are probably up. We talked about this earlier, Peter. Costs are probably up 25%, on construction, at least here locally. And so that's also driving that number. And it's going down a little bit. I see it moderating a little bit, but it's not going to go back to what it was 2 years ago.
I imagine steel costs about the same here as it does in Chicago,
right?
And that's one of the most interesting things about your business, and that is that you're competing to buy product that other cities will get a greater return on. In other words, that housing unit in Chicago, for example, will, by the nature of the marketplace and the average values in that marketplace, be worth more than the same piece of steel in your project here. So it must add to the whole complexity of the issue dealing in a place like Buffalo. Just comment for one thing, and like your reaction to it. One of the things about one of the reasons why I'm here, and perhaps why you're here as well, is that Buffalo is a very, very interesting and unique place. You came back here by choice, and I read your biography and why you came back here and the interest you have here beyond the business interest. It's your home, and that's the way I feel about it too. But as I look around, we have a very asset-rich community, and a lot of things that you've redeveloped are tremendous assets that were just laying fallow there, and you've brought them back to life. Yet we don't have the financial drive behind the individual family units and individuals in this community to support the assets that we have. How do you see this evolving? And you've been involved in politics too, so there's a political element to this as well, but how do you see that evolving, and where does our community go? How do we get back to a balance where we don't have to subsidize everything to get it done? Is that possible even?
That's a great observation, and it's a question that may take a little bit longer to answer than we have here. But I will say, those of us that live here, we love this community. We love Buffalo, and it extends, I think, to Rochester as well. Western New York in general is just a special place, and we all love it. The sense of community here is like none I've seen anywhere in the country, and that's what draws us back when we leave, and that's what keeps us here when we're here. But how does that look, and how is that sustainable over 5, 10, 15, 20 years is a great question. And, you know, I'm concerned about it because the pandemic was disruptive in many ways. And one of them was it created this ability to work from home or from afar, we should say, right? And so that's creating more of an incentive for folks to live in a more attractive place, right? And attractive is defined differently by different people. Some people like the warm weather. Some people like a more business-friendly environment, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we in Western New York and all across New York State have lost a lot of people, and they're the high-income-producing people that you're referencing. So, you know, how do we continue to grow the economy and enrich some of our natural resources here as a community and some of the cultural resources that we have in the community when, you know, a lot of folks are moving out of the region and likely not coming back? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is there. It's troubling. It's something we think about. It's something that we talk about quite a bit as a family and as a company. But, you know, the politicians really need to wake up and think about a solution here because their policies, at least in New York State government, at the government, the state level government, are driving a lot of that. And we take a bigger brunt of it here in upstate versus downstate, right? I mean, downstate, they have New York City and all the thriving resources that comes with that. And meanwhile, upstate here in Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and all the communities in between, we don't have those anchor businesses. We don't have those anchor institutions that can weather bad economic policy set forth by state governments. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge that I've spoken to quite a bit with other community leaders and business leaders and even local politicians that are frustrated because the our leadership here locally at the state level is much different in how they think about policies than the downstate folks, right? And I think it cuts across party. I think the Democrats in the Western New York delegation are much more business friendly, much more in tune with the question that you brought up than some of the downstate Democrats, right? So it's really more about upstate, downstate, in my opinion, than it is about Democrat versus Republican.
Well, I agree with you. Tim Kennedy's going to be on next week, so I'll be able to grill him a little bit on this topic because it's very near and dear to my heart, as I know it is to you. excuse me, I know how sensitive you are to the whole family issue here. You're married into a great family, and we lost your father-in-law during this pandemic, Gary Stott, one of the great citizens of our community, and my sympathies still extend to your family over that loss.
Thank you.
And but we've lost other people, fine quality people through the means that you discussed. In other words, they look around, they say, I don't need to be here physically anymore because of technology and the way of the world based on the experience that we all had during the pandemic. They say, why not save myself X percent of my income and just move south or move to a more business-friendly state? And as you accurately point out, it's not the average citizen here in Western New York that can do that. It's the wealthiest that are the most mobile and the youngest, frankly.
Right.
The youth and the wealthy people have less reason to be anywhere in particular than the rest of us that might be deeply rooted in this community. So it's a very interesting dilemma we face. We'll take one more call, and then we'd like to – I want to figure out a way to end this on a very positive note, Nick. So think about that as we take this call from Bob in Silver Creek. Bob, how can we help you?
Good morning. My wife and I are retired, and we're looking for housing in the city of Buffalo, mm-hmm. An urban environment. And one of the facilities we've looked at is the Canterbury Woods Gate Circle mm-hmm. Facility, which I think is a very nicely designed building, and the area, of course, is very nice. What troubles me is behind the building on Delaware Avenue is the remains of the Millard Fillmore mm-hmm. Nursing School.
Yep.
And my understanding is that has been earmarked as a potential affordable housing site.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, if you're looking at any of the units at the Gate Circle, the Canterbury Woods Gate Circle, that are on the side that faces that Millard Fillmore building, you would hesitate, at least in my mind, to commit to something because you just have no idea what's going to happen to that abandoned nursing school there. Do you have any thoughts on that, and do you know more about what is being planned for that piece of property?
It's a very good question.
Yeah, I know that site well. It's blocks away from our women's and children's hospital development that we talked about early, Elmwood Crossing, and it's blocks away from where I live. And so I don't know specifically what the plans are for that site, but I could tell you from experience, the pandemic really set a lot of these projects back for a number of reasons. There was work stoppages, financing costs have gone up, construction costs have gone up. So we have just recently gotten all of our six development projects back up online. So my hope and my guess would be is that developer has just gotten those plans back online and will likely start moving forward here soon on that redevelopment plan.
Yeah, and he points out a very interesting thing. You've got, just like you've got part that's under construction, brand new, spanking beautiful and everything else. Then right behind it is this thing that's been there forever. And people drive by, well, what's going on with that? And I think that's a very interesting question. I'm glad you clarified what you're doing at Elmwood Crossing. We've only got about a minute left here, Nick, and I just want to always try to end this on a positive note. You got a bunch of new stuff going on. I want to, first of all, compliment you on the project on Jefferson that you commented on a little while ago, and what you did, frankly, for Say Yes Buffalo, which is a huge thing. Dave Ross has been on many times on this show because I believe, as you do, in a program like that helps so many people. But what's next for the best thing for Sinatra and Company right now?
Well, that's a great question. So we've talked a lot about some of the challenges that we have here in New York State and Western New York, but the reality of it is that we live in a great community. And there's opportunity abound. And, we have a number of projects. I mentioned six different projects in the works. And we have a capital partner that we're bringing in from Boston that we can't announce yet. But they're, I think, part of the solution that we're going to hopefully have with affordable housing. So I think we're going to see a lot of new capital and new projects happen here in the community over the next few years. And that's really exciting because it's going to benefit everybody.
That is very exciting. Nick Sinatra, president of Sinatra & Company, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Peter. I enjoyed it.
Likewise. And I'd like to thank all of our listeners for being with us and remind everybody that we've got a brand new art gallery downtown Buffalo in the Brisbane Building. I invite you all there. It's the Hunt Art Gallery, C. Stewart, Jane H. Hunt Art Gallery. It's a little project of ours that we're very proud of. Fortunately, I have nothing to do with the selection of art, which is the very best thing. But we've got two great artists there, Bill Maggio and James Sedgwick right now, so we'd love to have you there. We'll be back next week at the same time. Remember, when it comes to real estate, all of upstate is hunt country.
WBEN Buffalo, WKSE 3 HD3 Niagara Falls.
Always live on the free Odyssey app.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's going to go. Alvarez ties the game.
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.